Hello and welcome to the Unsightly American Soccer Podcast for April 4, 2011. I'm your host, Hal Phillips. On this edition, we concentrate on the U.S. men's national team. And to do so, we visit with Tom Wadlington. We discuss the pair of riveting international friendlies played last week against Argentina and Paraguay. We also chat about the Champions League quarterfinals that begin tomorrow and continue on Wednesday. And as a special added bonus, we gather Tom's opinions on the controversial new statue that's been erected outside Craven Cottage, home to Fulham Football Club in London. Tom is perhaps America's most ardent Fulham fan, as you may know. So, why don't we check in with Tom on that right now before we get started talking about the U.S. men's national team?
What's happening?
I wanted to get an addendum here about your friends at Fulham and their new Michael Jackson statue.
Oh yeah, you want it right now?
I'm recording this, Tom, because I want it to be off the cuff and honest. What are your gut feelings about the King of Pop being enshrined at Craven Cottage?
Well, my personal feeling is that it's entirely apropos to Fulham Football Club, which is, while being a friendly family club that embraces people of all different types, it's eccentric and wacky and totally Fulhamish to have a weird statue of Michael Jackson, and most supporters are outraged and against it, and they're horrified. But to me, it's kind of funny. So that's all I have to say.
What about the? Have you seen pictures of the statue itself?
No, I haven't. Have you?
I've seen pictures of it here, and I'll read a description here from The Guardian that says that the statue depicts Jackson draped in ammunition belts and wearing what has been described as, quote, his underpants outside his trousers.
Oh, that outfit from that particular era that he was wearing weird outfits in.
Oh, which era was that?
Well, I know the one. He's wearing like some kind of weird cod piece and has some kind of strange bullet like vest on or something. I don't know. I vaguely remember it, but whatever. It's wacky and totally Fulhamish as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I applaud your equanimous and sort of tolerant behavior or attitude toward these things. I think it's laudable, highly laudable.
The only thing that would have been better than this particular Michael Jackson statue would have been if they added a monkey on his shoulder or in his arms or something.
Well, there you have it. Some candid comments there from Tom. Why don't we get right to the actual football chat? As you may know, last week the U.S. played two friendlies, one against Argentina. They drew 1-1 at the Meadowlands, and then they fell to Paraguay. 0-1, I guess, would be the technical score. That game was played in Nashville. A mixed bag of results, I think, and performances. Let's get right to the chat. Really interesting to see how different a team like Paraguay plays from a team like Argentina. And I think that the U.S. trotted out a much better lineup against Argentina and really got run off the park for half and fought back, you know, gallantly and actually got a goal against Argentina, of course. But they didn't play worse against Paraguay, but they got nothing from the game.
Yeah, so I think it's the U.S. is at a state in their soccer evolution where they can get a result, a draw or a win against the top five, top ten side in the world, Argentina, Germany, Brazil, whomever, and yet they can also end up losing to a team that's pretty average.
Yeah, and I don't think that's really a criticism, is it? I mean, you're not picking on them for that. I think that's totally true. And I think that, you know, in a lot of sports we'll say, oh, well, they just weren't ready to play against Paraguay. Well, number one, it's a friendly, and they took that opportunity to play some new guys and not kill some European-based players that, you know, whose fitness I think would have been, you know, hurt by playing two games in such close succession. But yeah, I mean, international football is like that. I mean, look at the World Cup. I mean, the U.S. did not look past Slovakia, didn't look past Algeria. These teams are good. And on any day, just as the U.S. can nick a point from Argentina or beat Spain in South Africa, you know, they can lose to Paraguay.
Right, right. So it was a good reality check. I think that the American players were probably pretty high about the fact that they were able to draw against Argentina when Argentina looked like the second coming of Brazil in 1970 in the first half. And this was a reality check. A team like Paraguay, they're okay. They're slightly above average. And you know, we got a lesson in defending, and we didn't create enough really good goal scoring opportunities.
No, I think that I think number one, you're selling Paraguay a little bit short. This team was, you know, quarter finalist at the World Cup and went out 1-0 to Spain and could have tied that game.
Yeah.
They're a very, very good side. And they're very, very difficult to play against. They're very, they're difficult to generate scoring chances against, as we saw against Spain and we saw last night. I mean, we're talking about the two best real opportunities they had last night were, you know, shots from outside the box. They did not really generate anything in the air, which, you know, this team usually does. Although they would have had some nice chances coming across from the left if Jonathan Bornstein weren't so completely useless.
Yes, he had another poor performance, and I'm one of the people that thinks that Bob Bradley has to give up on this idea that one day he's going to be a good left back for the U.S. It's just not going to happen.
He's had some very, very rough moments, and he's not that old, but he's not that young either anymore. Why in the world wouldn't you play someone like Lehigh or Chandler or even Cherundolo on the left rather than this guy? Because he's going to get forward and play the ball, you know, into the box properly. Well, he couldn't do that last night. He had two or three unbelievable opportunities to put the ball on goal, but more so to swing the ball across to Altidore, who's sitting on the spot waiting for it. And you could tell Altidore was incredibly pissed that he did not get that service.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Jonathan Bornstein, I just haven't seen anything that makes me believe he's going to evolve into a player that will be useful for the U.S. national team. And along those lines, you mentioned Jozy Altidore. I'm on the bandwagon that his development has stagnated or even regressed, especially when you see 18-year-old Juan Agudelo out there looking more confident and creating more and getting into the mix more than Jozy Altidore, who's now, you know, four or five seasons into being a professional in Europe.
Yeah, he's not getting the time to make those leaps. I agree, but I'll keep saying what I've been saying for the last 2 years. I mean, Altidore is not a world-class striker yet. Maybe he'll never be. And I'm happy to play someone else who is better. Who would that be?
Well, the problem is we haven't developed any world-class strikers.
Exactly.
And so for the time being, we can keep putting them out there. But at a certain point, we have to look to some other players to step up and take his place if he's not performing.
Who? Connor Casey?
Well, I'm not saying Connor Casey or
anyone. I'm willing to take any suggestions. I agree with you totally, but this guy is the best we've got. And in a lot of ways, he is very, very difficult to mark. And he occupies space. He holds the ball pretty well. And if he could just make the next leap, he's going to be a stud. I think everyone sees that.
Yeah, I think his work rate and dedication to training's always been in question. I don't see him hustle nearly as much as I would like to. Whereas Juan Agudelo, you see the desire, the hustle, and the passion to improve his game. And then the other thing with Altidore is if he's going to become anything, he needs to either learn how to turn defenders and make runs off their shoulders, or he needs to do what Bobby Zamora does at Fulham, which is hold the ball up and bring others into play. I don't think he's done particularly well at developing those skills. Yeah.
No, it was interesting last night just how much of the ball Agudelo saw and how deep he came into the middle third of the field to get the ball. And He didn't always do a wonderful job of holding it, although he did a pretty darn good job. And a lot of that might be attributed to the fact that Altidore was playing deeper, as more of a target, deeper in the box as opposed to a striker playing just behind, which is my impression of how they were aligned. Wasn't that yours, that Agudelo was playing, behind Altidore?
Absolutely. You saw Agudelo come all the way back to the top of the box in our defensive end on a number of occasions, and he received the ball and turned and ran at people in between the top of our box and midfield on a number of occasions. Altidore, you rarely see that with him. And I worry that his dribbling skills and running at people haven't improved. His work rate hasn't improved. And his ability to turn defenders or even hold the ball up has not improved.
Just to be fair, what I was trying to say was that if you're playing two strikers, one is usually more withdrawn and one is further forward.
Right.
And Agudelo was definitely the one who was withdrawn. And everything you said about Altidore was true. And you could also say about, Cardoso, who played that same position for Paraguay last night. He wasn't coming back and getting the ball on top of the box or running at anybody. His role is to play with his back to goal as deep as he can. And he happened to jump on a loose ball in the box and score. Yeah. So he had a good night, and Altidore didn't do that, so he had a bad night. So I think it's a bit fickle to judge, Altidore in this way, and this is the way strikers are always judged, and as a former striker, I'm sensitive to this. If you don't score, you've played badly, and you can play the best game you've ever played and not score, and that's just the way it goes.
Yeah, I would say that's a slight exaggeration. If Altidore managed to play the way that Bobby Zamora or... if he managed to play well and do the right things without scoring, I think we'd all be fairly happy with him.
Well, but, I think that against – okay, let's talk about Argentina. I think he did that against Argentina. I think he did exactly what you're talking about. His work rate was good. He held the ball better. He was more involved against Argentina. He didn't score. He didn't really even – nothing he did led to the goal. But he played well. In fact, in the World Cup last summer, I thought he played very well. He did not score. You keep bringing up Zamora. This was the knock on Zamora for years, was that, how much can a striker really do without scoring? They say the same thing about Heskey in England. But, I think that Altidore does do a lot and is dangerous and does play deep and does wear down defenders and does occupy at least one or two of them, creating space for others. But, you're right. He doesn't turn people as well as some strikers do, and he does play a lot of games where it seems we're talking about he played well but didn't create anything, and ultimately that gets in the way.
So my vision of him in the future is he's never going to be a goal scorer of any significance. I don't think he has a real good football brain, and I think that, yes, he occupies a defender or two, and he's a fairly strong guy. I'm not sure he's as strong as his physique would lead you to believe. But I think his future is in being the hold up striker who brings others into play and learns how to shield the ball and dish it off to his teammates who are coming up to attack.
Let me just offer a couple of numbers here for perspective. 11, 6. 1989.
Okay.
That's Jose Altidore's birthday. He's 21 years old. He will not turn 22 until November. And I think that the jury remains, and should be out on this guy. He's got too many tools to give up on. And like I say, as soon as there's a better option to throw in there and give a chance to play at the highest level, I'm willing to play this guy, even beside someone like Agudelo. I thought that was one of the best things about that game last night, is that they played 70 minutes next to each other.
Yeah. So let's face it. The future in Brazil 2014 is Altidore and Agudelo up front as strikers, and with Altidore not showing me that he's going to be a goal scorer in the future, except here and there. We're looking at a U.S. team that's relying on midfielders, attacking midfielders like Landon Donovan and Clint Dempsey coming up whether it be from the flanks or up the middle, to get into the play, they need a really quality striker who's going to hold up the ball and dish it off to them. I pray that by the next World Cup in Brazil, he's mastered or dramatically improved at least one key skill set necessary to be a target man for the national team.
I don't want to come off as a Jose Altidore apologist. He does have a long way to go, but the guy's only 21, and I can't believe it's not going to happen. He's just got too much going on, and, you know, Villarreal, you know, bought him for a reason. All these teams give him, you know, these chances for a reason. They see what I see. And, you know, it takes a while for a striker to evolve. But let's talk about the Argentina game a little bit, because a lot of the things that we're talking about you're wanting him to do, he did, I think, against that team, but... But something you said just now was resonated with me. You know, this team relies quite rightly on its strength, which is the center of midfield now. And I can't believe I'm saying that. You know, for so long that was the Achilles heel of this team. But you know, even when they're getting pounded by a better team like Argentina, you know, the ability to counter does not come from a striker being able to hold the ball up. It comes from, you know, having talent and speed and wherewithal to counter quickly through midfield. And they did that in the second half against Argentina. And, you know, Argentina didn't lay down in the second half. But what they did was they allowed, or at least the U.S. stepped up and took the ball and relatively coolly attacked after Argentina had attacked them. It was great to watch.
Yes, I totally agree. It seems as though Argentina got tired of attacking relentlessly by the second half, and the U.S. finally probably stopped believing that they were going to, you know, be victimized by this tremendous team, and they got some belief that they could attack in the second half, and that made a huge difference.
And they could have added another, and obviously so could Argentina. But I guess it was interesting to me to see Argentina play such a strong squad for so long. There was no interest there to sort of – this was not an exhibition in the formal sense for them. They weren't just coming together to, you know, make some money at the expense of the United States Soccer Federation and 80,000 people at the New Meadowlands. They played their stars the whole game. They wanted to win it. They just couldn't.
Yeah, so there are a couple of interesting things about Argentina at this juncture. With the new coach taking over from Maradona, you have Cambiaso and Javier Zanetti coming back into the lineup, and some of Maradona's crazy picks have been left off the new Argentina team. Also, the fact that Lionel Messi is one of the hardest working players, as well as probably the most talented player in the world, makes them a team that is not going to sit back and just pass the ball around for your aesthetic pleasure.
The team that Batista chose and has chosen, I guess, for the last couple of games is a complete and utter rebuke to Maradona. I mean, Zanetti's there, Cambiaso is there, these older defensive-minded guys that give them, you know, a more fully evolved side and not just an attacking side means they're hard to score against in a way that wasn't true in South Africa last summer. But, you know, Messi, the same thing you say about Messi is the same thing people say about Barcelona. And how hard they work is what makes them so difficult to play against, not necessarily how gifted they are. Messi's, I think, a funny case, though. He does work incredibly hard with the ball and when his teammates have the ball, and he does work incredibly hard when he loses it, or someone near him loses it. He does dog, you know, that player relentlessly. But, yeah, you know, he's really only concerned with one half of the field. You know, Messi's not the same kind of hardworking guy as a guy like Xavi is, although they have the same mentality and play for the same club. It's just interesting watching Argentina play with Messi and watching Barcelona play with Messi. You're struck by the same thing. I mean, there's no time. I mean, they're just on you.
Yeah. So I noticed very, very vividly that Messi was running back all the way into the defensive end of the U.S. I'm sorry, the other way around. He was coming back to help his team defend and taking the ball off of unsuspecting people dribbling for the U.S., and I mean, the work rate, I think part of that was responsible for their letdown in the second half. I think they burned out with a strategy of let's attack and pressure them and take the ball off them the entire first half, and we'll just score a couple goals and then sit back and defend in the second half.
Yep, I think that was the plan, and they only scored one, and that's why they ended up drawing and not winning, because I don't know that the U.S. was a danger to score more than once.
Right, exactly. So let's talk about some of the U.S. players that appear to be on the ascendancy in terms of their futures with the U.S. national team, and I think you have to start with the fellow they're calling Timmy Chandler. Is that correct?
Yes.
Even though he's born and raised in Germany to a U.S. serviceman and a German woman, he has surprised people and I think made people believe he can succeed Steve Cherundolo at right back going forward.
Well, apparently he plays midfielder for his club side. He's really more that type of player than a right back. He jumped up into the midfield late in the game against Paraguay when they brought on Eric Lehi and took off who did they take off? Take off Adu and moved Dempsey up to forward.
Right, right.
But he plays for Nuremberg in Germany and is only 21 years old and showed a lot of speed, a lot of savvy, obviously some versatility, and actually served the ball beautifully. I can't say that I knew a whole lot about this guy, other than the fact that he was, you know, an American by virtue of his parentage, although he did grow up in Germany. Why is it that these people have to play right side, left side? I mean, there's an advantage to a player who's right-footed playing on the left flank. He can cut the ball in a way that you can't. And, you know, if all we're getting out of Bornstein with his beautiful left foot are the kind of crosses he serves up, you know, Where's the loss?
Well, I totally agree with you, and I think you must be referring to my stellar play at left back as a right-footed player who was equally adept with both feet.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking of. Thank you for clarifying that.
So when you talk about Chandler, yes, in an ideal world, Chandler could just as easily slot in at left back where the U.S. has had a massive hole for years, and we could have Eric Lehi be the guy who succeeds Steve Cherundolo at right back.
And you know, Cherundolo is still a top flight right back. I mean, he's playing so well. I think he's captaining Hanover now in Germany, is he not?
That is correct.
And you know, how old is he? 30?
I think he's 33.
Is he really that old?
I believe so.
Wow. Well, then it really is unreasonable to expect him to be fit for the World Cup in 2014. He'll be quite old. So these are important matters. What'd you think of Tim Ream?
I read some columnists say that he had a good game. What I saw was giving the ball away a few times in dangerous positions and not looking as confident with the ball at his feet as I would have liked to see.
Well, he fell down on the goal, and that was, I think, more unfortunate than derelict. And, what can you say about that? He did give the ball away a couple times. But more so, I was struck by his ability to look down the field and make really penetrating sort of passes on the ground to people's feet out of the back. They had talked about his ability to do this. I can't say that I've seen him play for MLS more than a couple times. But I thought he looked pretty comfortable. And in fact, even after he gave the ball away a couple times, he didn't stop doing, you know, what he does. And it certainly stood in stark contrast to what Gooch does in the same position, which is, you know, if it's not right in front of him and obvious, he just freaking boots it because he's just got no confidence to pick that ball out and no confidence in his teammates to take that ball and do something with him. So I was sort of impressed.
Okay. Maybe people were looking for any improvement upon Oguchi on Yewu's performance against Argentina. If Tim Ream showed some glimpses of promise, that's good. But in the meantime, the U.S. is going to have to basically come up with a whole new defensive back line going into the next World Cup.
They're on their way. I like Goodson. I like Ream. I like Lehi. I like Chandler. And, when are Frankie Simek and Who's the other guy who plays for Norwich and plays in the championship? American.
Zach Whitbread.
Zach Whitbread. I'd like to see these guys get a shot.
The question is how are these players going to develop, and in the next 2 to 3 years, will they end up being better players than Carlos Bocanegra, Chirundolo, Onyewu, and the other guys that they're replacing? One can only hope so. They look to have more skill, more speed, and if they develop in terms of their positional play and their smarts, they should be improvements.
Really, any national team has its weaknesses, and right now that's where it is. In the middle, in the back, in the middle, up top, there just aren't obvious choices and obvious world-class choices yet. But, you know, we were saying the same thing about defensive midfield and attacking midfield, no more than 2 or 3 years ago, and these people just, you know, they show up.
Well, we'll see what happens with the under-20 World Cup. The U.S. has some young players that are supposed to be very talented, more skillful than their predecessors, but it's always a question as far as who's going to make that leap to be an international quality player that's an automatic starter on a team that'll go to the World Cup.
You know, it's hard not to think of what, you know, might have been with some passport, you know, players if Rossi decides to play for the U.S. We're not having this conversation about Jozy Altidore, and if Sabotic doesn't decide to play for Serbia, you know, we're not having the same kind of discussion there either.
Right, exactly. That would have been, you would have had a 21-year-old in Nevin Sabotic that would be your anchor as a center back for the next 10 years or more, and you would have had, 22-year-old Giuseppe Rossi, who chose Italy instead of the U.S. as your key striker, that could be paired with someone like Altidore or Agudelo for years to come.
Yeah. So, oh, well, it's spilled milk. Let's not cry over it.
Yeah, I guess you have to ask yourself, who would you choose if you were Rossi or Sabotic? Would you choose Italy, Serbia, or the U.S.?
Well, I think Rossi's situation is, if he's really going to play, it's obvious, but I don't know how much he's really been rewarded for that decision. And Sabotic's decision, I don't understand at all. I mean, Serbia, you know, every second World Cup has a decent enough side that, you know, might make it to the final eight, but they don't even have as much sort of upside as a team like the Czech Republic has. I think that he made a foolish choice. I mean, the U.S., you know, like it, love it or hate it, is on the rise and is going to play in every World Cup, guaranteed. That can't be ignored. I mean, if you're choosing a country like Serbia, and, you know, he might have legitimate sort of ancestral and emotional reasons for doing it. I don't want to minimize that. But if you're looking at wanting to play in every World Cup for the next, you know, 12 years, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, I think your chances of making the World Cup are going to be greater simply because the U.S. is in a much weaker region and will pretty much qualify automatically for each World Cup from CONCACAF than Serbia trying to battle it out with the European powers. So I think he ultimately chose Serbia because of his parents' history in that country.
Well, all in all, a very interesting week of U.S. men's national team friendlies here stateside, and we can look forward to another batch of them coming up in June when Spain visits Foxborough, Massachusetts. You're going to be there, Tom?
Yes, I'm hoping that that David Bautista is buying tickets as we speak.
Yeah, I hope so, and I think we should do a tailgate there.
Yeah, it'll be a sellout, and hopefully Spain will bring a full squad so that we can see the magicianry of people like Xavi and Iniesta and the whole crew, David Villa. Who am I forgetting?
Well, Iniesta, Xavi, Busquets, Piqué, I mean, the entire Barcelona squad plus the other cream. But the reality is they could bring their second team, and it would be a difficult game to get anything from, but I hope they bring the stars. Quickly, Tom, what do you think about Champions League? Had Tottenham against Real. Tottenham have a chance?
Tottenham has a chance. Tottenham's one of those teams where on their day, they're as good as any team in the world, but their day doesn't seem to come around often enough. And they seem to have defensive lapses that cause them to leak goals. So I would say chances are they're going to lose to Real Madrid, but I hope they win.
I think if they get a goal in Madrid, they can win that tie, not easily, but it's definitely doable. But they've got to score in Madrid.
Yes, and is that the first leg of the tie?
I believe that is so. And I also wanted to ask you about Barca Shakhtar, because I know that you've seen Shakhtar in person, and we're very impressed with them.
Yes, that I saw somebody tweeting. One of the U.S. national team players was tweeting about the quarterfinal matchups in Champions League, and I replied that Barcelona Shakhtar Donetsk could be the best football match, the best quality of football played in Champions League in many years, maybe ever. This team with Shakhtar Donetsk has 6, 7, 8 Brazilians, and I don't know how they stay warm out in the frozen tundra there. But these guys are a whirlwind of movement and crisp passing, and they could match Barcelona in terms of their footballing capabilities.
What about Chelsea, Man U? I hesitate to even ask you. I know how objective you are about all things Chelsea.
Yeah, that's kind of like asking, would you rather have Gaddafi or Hussein in power? I really don't like either team. I'd be happier to see Chelsea go out of the competition and be tremendously disappointed and have the Russian billionaire owner fire the coach and the entire staff, chop some heads off as well. But I wouldn't be that happy to see Man United go forward either. Wednesday, April 6th, please write this down, 2:45 p.m. Eastern Time, Barcelona will host Shakhtar Donetsk. It could be the best football match you've ever seen.
All right, then. I think we should leave it there, Tom, on that very note.
Okay, beautiful.
Thanks, as always, for the knowledge, Tom.
Take care.